As is so often the case in Japanese animation, displacement and emotional upheaval lead to interaction with the supernatural. Again, that's A Letter from Momo, Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
That was the voice of Langston Hughes reading.
I went to Columbia University.
Ah, okay, that was too, but a different form. What you heard was Langston Hughes reading The Negro Speaks of Rivers, and this recording is on a CD called The African American Experience. I'm Patricia Welch of Black Book Talk.
And I'm Ovi Hill with Reflections Mirror Image Books.
And we are delighted to invite, once again, Renee Watson. Renee, hello. Welcome again to Black Book Talk.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
The reason why we opened with Langston Hughes, besides the fact that it's always wonderful to hear his voice and hear his poetry, is that Renee is involved in a wonderful project in New York, in Harlem, to preserve his home. And we always like to track when hometown girls, and Renee is absolutely a Portland girl, but she is in Harlem and doing wonderful things. We wanted to hear about that, and we'll also want to talk about her upcoming books. So, Renee, tell us a little bit about what you're doing in Harlem with Langston Hughes' home.
So I moved to New York a little over 10 years ago now. And when I first moved here, the first place I wanted to go to was Harlem. And I found the block named after Langston Hughes and got to stand in front of it, brownstone. And I was in awe of it, but also sad because it was empty. And it had been empty for quite some time. And so over the years, you know, I just continued to walk past it. I don't live too far from it. And I kept saying, man, someone ought to do something about that. Why? How is it possible that that's empty and it's not a space for poets and for young people to come in and learn about his legacy? And, you know, after a while, you just can't keep waiting for other people to do things. So I decided that I was going to try to lease the brownstone, renovate it, and open it. So I've launched a nonprofit called I2 Arts Collective, which is inspired by a title from his poem. And we are fundraising and working our very best to raise money by the end of the month to be able to lease the brownstone and open up shop so that young people can come in and have a space to create and to learn and to grow.
Sounds wonderful.
Our third member is on the phone here now. Emma, are you there?
I am here. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Okay, you know, I'm curious, Renee, how much money, I don't know how long you've been doing this fundraising, but how much money have you raised so far, if you don't mind saying?
So we have raised $12,600. We started 9 days ago.
Oh.
So in 9 days, we've raised $12,000. So the campaign is going strong. I feel so supported from the children's literature community, from poets from all around the nation. People are contributing and also supporting by donating gifts. So, you know, when you donate to the campaign, you can choose a perk, a little gift. And so at different levels, there are signed books from renowned authors like Jacqueline Woodson. There's author visits through Skype. So even if you don't live in New York City, your school or library could pay for a an author visit, and they will Skype in and talk with your group for a 45-minute visit. And those authors include Jason Reynolds and Jackie as well. So we have a lot of different opportunities for people to participate, from $5 on up, to help us pull this off.
Now, is the facility already open, or what is your target date?
No, so we would sign the lease at the end of August, hopefully, and begin renovations September, October, and November. And then we would do a soft opening in December to celebrate the holidays and do a throwback to the 20s and have like a Harlem Renaissance party and let people come in, see the space, auction off some artwork from local Harlem artists. And then after the new year, we'll start like an official launch and open up with a book release of my new book, Keeping Me Together, that comes out on Valentine's Day 2017. So that'll be our big launch. And then from there, we'll start our programming, which our first year programming will be focusing on creative conversations, which is having artists of all disciplines come into the space and share works in progress with the community and do talk back sessions and discussions. I'm really wanting this space to be a living, thriving space, not a museum, not a place where we just come in and look at art or only experience polished, finished pieces. So I wanted to provide space for working artists, emerging artists to come in and workshop their material. And then we'll do a summer intensive program and invite young people to come in who are interested in poetry and do an intensive writing workshop for 2 weeks in the summer.
I want to go back to what you were saying about the authors. So children's authors can be Skyped into, say, a school library?
Is sure, that more yeah. A school library, a local library. I'm sorry?
Is that for a donation to the effort for Langston?
Right. So we have different levels of donating that begin at $5 and go all the way up to $1,000. And there are school visits that are offered at, I don't know them by heart, I think it's one is $450, some are $500, some are $800. So if a library or a school or a community center wants to invite an author, they will Skype in and visit for a 45-minute talk, which would include them reading their work and taking questions from the people who are in the room.
Okay, thank you.
That's a whole lot less than bringing an author in, transportation, right. Lodging, et cetera. To me, this is fascinating. It shows the power of social media and the internet that you just started 9 days ago, and you've raised over $12,000. What is your goal?
So our goal, there are two goals. The first goal that will get us keys and really signing the lease is $40,000.
Okay.
If I can raise that by the end of August, we can sign a lease and begin renovations and go ahead and start. My second goal, my overall goal, is to raise $150,000, because that will cover renovations, the lease for the year, and also programming costs. So we're trying to make sure that we have, you know, some cushion for the year and really can launch in a powerful, strong way and not be a struggling nonprofit in our first year. So that's what the campaign goals are.
Well, I certainly hope you succeed, because what you're doing in New York, and admittedly, Langston Hughes is nationally recognized and revered, so I think that makes it easier for you to pull from a national pool of donors. But still, the same kind of thing that you're doing there can be done throughout the country, and I'm hoping that people who know about your project in various cities and towns will look at what is historically valid and interesting and worthy of preservation in their towns. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of beautiful buildings here in Portland that have significance, and, you know, they will be lost unless people say, wait a minute, you know, we're not just losing a building, we're losing some important history that we need to be aware of and we need to be inspired by. So, you know, I certainly encourage you. I think that we can say, yeah, I'm pretty sure we can actually, where people can go to make that donation if people want to participate in something that is really I hope a landmark effort, where would they go?
They can visit my website. My website has a page that will direct them to our campaign page. Mm-hmm. And you can find me at reneewatson.net. And my name is with two E's.
Okay. Let's see. So we want to say for those, I mean, everybody out here is not a speller. So
okay.
reneewatson.net.
Okay.
So after it's up and running, will there be a fee charged to use the space, and that's how you'll maintain the lease every year?
Some of our programming will have a fee, and we are also, you know, we're a nonprofit organization, so we'll be applying for grants as well. My goal is to have a place be accessible to the people, so I do not want to charge a lot for people to use a space, or for me, that defeats the purpose. So yes, we will have minimal fees for some of the programming, but I'm hoping to raise money through grants and continue private fundraising as well. I want to, you know, what Patricia was saying is so important about spaces being preserved and kind of like the erasure that's happening across the nation of places, and especially Black communities, with gentrification happening so many times, the newness and the new development and the urban renewal pushes people out, and not only those people, but their stories. And so if we don't have these spaces to remind us that we were here, we existed, that art was made in powerful ways, I think there's something lost. The collective story gets lost and broken, and our young people don't have something to look to as an example of strength and something to look back to learn from. So I'm really hoping that this is more than just, you know, a building. Anyone can just get a brownstone and do something in it. For me, it's about his legacy and what he stood for and his art making that's important to keep alive in a place like Harlem that is changing rapidly, like so many African-American communities across the nation.
Well, hopefully with that lease, you'll have a lease with an option to buy. A lot of times we carry up other people's loads and forget to own our own load, and that's why these gentrification projects succeed and we are out.
Right. So thankfully, the owner is open to that, and, you know, we are a small nonprofit in the very beginning stages, and so right now we cannot buy it, but that is the goal, is you know, at least to own agreement. So we will be working on that, and I agree with you, as much as we can own property, I think that that's important to keep our communities thriving and to keep us here in the spaces where we want to be. Absolutely.
I want to know a little bit more about the I2 Collective, I2 mm-hmm. Arts Collective. How did this come about? Who are the other members? It's always good to hear about people collaborating on things.
So I have just an amazing group of people who are helping me behind the scenes. Some of them are members of We Need Diverse Books. I don't know if you know about that amazing organization, but...
tell us a little bit about that. I'm not familiar with that.
So, you know, it's happening, I feel like, in every sector. There's conversations about diversity and how do we remain intentional and thoughtful about what we put out into the world. And I'm talking about as writers and artists. So We Need Diverse Books as an organization that is striving to make sure that a wide range of voices have access to the publishing world, that our stories get told, not just get told, but by us. So by people from marginalized groups, that we tell our own stories, and that we're, you know, not just as the maker of art, but even in the publishing roles as editor and marketing teams and things like that, that we're trying to diversify the publishing industry at large in every aspect of the making and creation of books for young people. So I have a team of people who are helping me from that organization, and a wonderful crew of honorary board members, Chris Myers, Meg Medina, just wonderful people who've come on board to help me and who are pushing to fundraise and just support my efforts. So it's been a whole community of people, mostly writers, mm-hmm. But not all children's lit writers. We have some poets, too, who are involved. And it really just started with me asking. You know, I wanted to do this, and I knew that I couldn't do it by myself. And I knew that people cared about Langston and his legacy. So I just reached out to my people. I really did. It was very casual, just calling people, having coffee dates and saying, this is what I want to do. I need you to help me. How can you help? What would you like to do to, you know, get on board? And I was overwhelmed with the response from the community of people who wanted to help and contribute and volunteer to get this off the ground.
Great.
You're listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO, and our guest is Renee Watson. Tell me a little bit about this Bloomsbury organization, Children's Books.
Oh, that's my publisher. So they are, you know, a publisher like Random House. My picture books are with Random House, and my novels are with Bloomsbury. And so they published What Mama Left Me, which was my first novel, and The Sight of Home, and now we are releasing Piecing Me Together in February.
Okay, let's hear a little bit about Piecing Me Together.
So I feel like it's a sister book to This Sight of Home, in that it takes place in Portland again, or further north. So This Sight of Home was in Northeast Portland, and Piecing Me Together is in North Portland. And it really is about a young girl who's literally trying to piece her life together. She, when she's with her family and her mentors, feels very much whole and loved and cherished, feels like she can conquer the world. She has people in her life telling her, you can be anything you want to be, you can do anything you want to do, you are beautiful, you are powerful. And then she goes out into the world that is sometimes sexist and racist, and sometimes is calling her ugly because of her dark skin and her thickness and her weight. And so she gets broken and shattered into many pieces when she's at this all-white school on the other side of town, when she's in the mall and being followed because she's a Black girl. And then when she hears the news of a person who is assaulted by the police who looks like her. And so the book is about how she pieces her life back together. And her question is, can a Black girl ever feel whole? Can she ever leave the house and not have to come undone? Can she come back and still remain intact with those promises from the people who love her, who keep telling her that this world is hers and that she belongs here and should be happy and have all the success in her life? So she learns these lessons from her mentor and from her mom. So it's a book about friendship and sisterhood and the different kind of relationships with women that kind of nurture her and grow her up a bit. So those are some of the themes in the book.
And that's coming out in February?
Yes, it comes out on Valentine's Day, 2017.
Well, on that Valentine's Day, that's the birthday of the state of Oregon. Maybe we may be able to do something here.
I would love to come home and share the book with Portland. I would love that.
You know, for those who don't know, and also just because I happen to love this book, could you tell us a little bit about This Sight of Home? You said, you know, that the new book is kind of like a partner or a companion book to that. Tell us about the first book, because I'm not, you know, some people specialize in children's books, adults who specialize in that, and others love a lot of YA books. I don't read a lot of YA books, but I love this book. I tell people about this book. I love to read just the first page of the book. It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us about that. And also, if you have a copy of Piecing Me Together, if you could read just a little bit of that, you know, to give us a sense of what's coming up. But first, tell us about This Sight of Home.
So This Sight of Home is about twin sisters, identical twin sisters, Maya and Nikki, who live and have lived in this neighborhood their whole lives, and it's changing. The word gentrification is not in the book, but that is what's happening. And one of the twins, Nikki, is really excited about all the coffee shops and the new stores and all of the trendy restaurants, but her sister Maya, who's the main character, is frustrated and sad because it's pushing out her neighbors, including her best friend, who has lived directly across the street from her whole life. So when her best friend moves to the other side of town and a white family moves in, Maya's really upset about that because the landlord flips the house and makes it really nice. But then she starts to have feelings for the boy who moves in, who's white, and she's just confused about how can I love someone who represents what I'm so angry about. So the book is about her coming to terms with how do you hold on to your legacy and keep your roots intact, but also accept change and accept newness.
And
I started writing that. I tell this story a lot. I started writing the story about 20 years ago when I was in high school. It was a short story. When I went to Jefferson High School, I was in Linda Christensen's class, and it was a short story because that's when Portland was starting to change. Alberta Street was starting to change.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have the language for that. I didn't know what that meant, but I could feel that it wasn't for us. I just felt that, and I didn't, at 16, know how to articulate that, but over the years, as I, just got older and understood really what was happening, I returned to that story because I think sometimes things are going on and adults, we're talking about it on a one kind of level, and we don't realize that young people are also feeling these things and watching and being affected by it. And so I'm hoping through my books to give some kind of access for young people to process what they're thinking about and feeling in terms of race and class and issues that are affecting them that sometimes they're not allowed to talk about because no one's asking them how they feel.
And I think you do that so well. Do you have a copy of Piecing Me Together with you?
I do.
Could you read maybe just a little bit? We have about 7 or 8 minutes left, so if you could do that and still allow time for if there are any final questions, but I think we all want to hear from this work.
Okay. Can you give me a moment? I'm going to look for a part to read.
Okay. While you're looking for a part to read, can you tell us when you'll be back in Portland?
I will be back in Portland in September. I won't be doing any events. I'm actually going to just spend some time with my mama and my nephews and get some family time in and just take a break for a little bit. But I'll be in Portland. I cannot wait. I'm almost counting down days to be able to come back. But as far as events and things of that nature, I'm pretty sure I'll be back in February doing something around Piecing Me Together. So I'll make sure that you all know and that I publicize it and celebrate with Portland this new book. I'm going to read from the middle. But she makes art. She's a budding artist, and she loves to make collage, which is kind of a metaphor for piecing her life together. So she takes everyday things that people discard, and she makes collages out of them. So the book reads like a collage. There are short chapters, and some are poems, and some are just lists. So this is kind of a mixture of that. And I'll read about the scene that I referenced earlier. I'll read from the scene that I referenced earlier. 12. There are 12 girls who've been selected for the woman-to-woman mentorship program. 12 seeds, 12 prayers, 12 daughters, 12 roots, 12 histories, 12 reasons, 12 rivers, 12 questions, 12 songs, 12 smiles, 12 yesterdays, 12 tomorrows. As I sit and listen to everything that Sabrina is telling me, I wonder if she understands that the things that she's saying feel impossible. She keeps saying that we can be anything. She tells us, you have to believe you are worthy of love, of happiness, that you are worthy of your wildest dreams coming true. When she says this, so many thoughts rush through my mind. I am thinking about how Mom had plenty of dreams and how EJ is not short on self-confidence. And Lily has known she wants to be a poet since we were in middle school. So it can't be just about believing and dreaming. My neighborhood is full of big dreamers, but I know that that doesn't mean those dreams will come true. I know something happens between the time our mothers and fathers and teachers and mentors send us out into the world, telling us the world is yours, and you are beautiful, and you can be anything, and the time will return to them. Something happens when people tell me I have a pretty face, ignoring me from the neck down. When I watch the news and see unarmed black men and women shot dead over and over, it's kind of hard to believe this world is mine. Sometimes it feels like I leave home a whole person. Sent off with kisses from mom, who is hanging her every hope on my future. By the time I get home, I feel like my soul has been shattered into a million pieces. Mom's love repairs me. Whenever mom's cooking is simmering on the stove and EJ's music is filling every inch of the house, I am making my art, and I believe everything these women are saying about being worthy of good things. Those are the times I feel secure, just fine. I look in the mirror and see my dad's eyes looking back at me, my mom's thick hair, thick everything, and that's when I believe my dark skin isn't a curse, that my lips and hips, hair and nose don't need fixing, that my dream of being an artist and traveling the world isn't foolish. Listening to these mentors, I feel like I can prove the negative stereotypes about girls like me wrong, that I can and will be more, do more. But when I leave, it happens again, the shattering. And this makes me wonder if a black girl's life is only about being stitched together and coming undone, being stitched together and coming undone. I wonder if there's ever a way for a girl like me to feel whole. Wonder if any of these women can answer that.
That is beautiful.
Wow.
Wow. That is a very bright lady, young lady. She's in the numerology, it seems to me. She's dealing in numbers of 12s. How did you go about this type of accountability?
So Jade is bright, and I wanted a girl who is like the many, many students I've met and that I know who are in the classrooms that I visit, in my family, in my church. I know brilliant, smart black girls, and I wanted a book about that type of girl. So she gets a mentor because they think that she needs guidance and she needs all this support and help because she's poor. And you know, just because you don't have money doesn't mean that you don't have other things that can actually make you wealthy. So she gets this mentor who's kind of just out of touch and is coming to save her and rescue her from the hood. And really, Jade teaches her mentor a lot, and her mentor does end up teaching her some things too. But yeah, it's important for me to, I write realistic fiction, and so I want it to be realistic, which means every character that I'm going to write is not going to be the down and out, you know, inner city story, because I know people who are living in under-resourced communities, but who definitely are thriving and are brilliant. And so I wanted a character who reflected the girls that I know.
Whenever one of us is out of the studio, those of us who are in the studio try to give a pause to make sure that they get their question again. So Emma, we were pausing for you.
You were pausing for me, and I was sitting here thinking about her words about her character, the character that she's built. So I was not in questioning mode. I was like, whoa, I was in awe mode.
I know what you mean. Well, I just want to say thank you for that, because that's what people don't get. That riches are about more than money, mm-hmm. and that folks who live in thriving, loving, supportive black communities like the one that I grew up in,
yes.
we have wonderful lives. And since I've been up here, people talk, somebody was saying something about segregation, and I said, this is going to sound totally apolitical or something, but I'm glad I grew up in a little segregated Baltimore community, because I did not grow up as a black child who was like exceptionally this or that or bright. I just grew up as a black child, and I mean, you were smart, dumb, in between, but we were whole people, and that's what you don't get. That's why people love your work, because you do tell a truth that you can only tell when you're from the inside of the situation, and you know that truth. So yeah, thank you. I think we're all kind of like, whoa, and we can't wait for you to come home in February.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm, you know, I love to come back home, so I'm looking forward to it too.
Okay, you know, we did an intro with Langston Hughes, and now we have an outro that has Langston and music. So I guess it's our turn to say, my turn. This is Patricia Welch of Black Book Talk. Looking forward to talking to you in September.
O.B. Hill with Reflections Mirror Image Books, the same.
Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman. See you next month.
Now in session. His Honor, Judge Pigmeat Martin Poseidon.
Everybody,
the coat of swing is just about ready to do that thing. I don't want no tears, I don't want no lies. Above all, I don't want no alibis. This judge is hip, and that ain't all. He'll give you time if you're big or small. Fall in line, or this coat is neat. Peace, brother.
Lotto, here comes the judge.
In the quarter of the Negroes, Belgium shadows Leopold. Premier Downing aging, General Boss beleaguered, Eastland and Marlin deceased, dead or alive, dead or alive, dead or alive, their ghosts cast shadows, their ghosts cast shadows, their ghosts cast shadows in the quarter of the Negroes, shadows,
shadows, shadows,
shadows, shadows. Shadows.